From Wyoming to Tennessee, South Carolina to Michigan, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Federal Department of Education spends billions of taxpayer dollars on K-12 public education, yet test scores are at a low point. Lindsay Burke of the Heritage Foundation is here to discuss the failure. Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives defied expectations and advanced one big beautiful bill to enact President Trump's policy agenda. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. U.S. Senator Rand Paul is determined to find out exactly how the COVID-19 virus came into being. He talks about his efforts with Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine. And Donald Trump is the only world leader who can broker a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Billions of taxpayer dollars have been spent, yet test scores are at an all-time low. That is why President Donald Trump is calling for elimination of the Federal Department of Education. Lindsay Burke testified before a congressional committee this past week. She is director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation and joins us now to discuss the issue. Lindsay, welcome to American Radio Journal. Lindsay, you had the opportunity this past week to appear before the Labor HHS Appropriations Subcommittee in the U.S. House of Representatives to talk about the money that U.S. taxpayers, all of us, pay when it comes to K-12 education. It seems like there's been not a lot of return on investment, if you will, for the money. Want to tell us a bit about what you told the members of Congress?
I told Congress, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan, we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem when it comes to K-12 and higher education, but particularly with federal spending on K-12 education. We have seen, if you look throughout the 20th century, inflation-adjusted per-pupil spending increased on average 3.5% per year every single year. And so if you add all of that up, it's more than tripled in real terms federal spending since 1965. And so we have just seen a tremendous amount of money poured in to K-12 education, particularly from the federal level, and to your point, just have not seen commensurate increases or improvements in educational outcomes, either educational achievement outcomes or attainment outcomes like graduation rates for American children.
How bad is it when it comes to those outcomes here, Lindsay? I understand that we're not only at a pre-COVID low, but actually a low going back a lot further.
Well, that's right. It's bad. The COVID outcomes we knew were going to be very poor, but we didn't expect exactly how bad they would be. And so if you look just over the past few years, we saw for fourth graders and eighth graders, reading outcomes fell an average of 2 points since 2022, declining from what were already historic lows in 2022. Reading scores in particular fell in 48 out of 50 states for children. They are down 8 points just since 2015. And that might not sound like a lot to your listeners, but to put it in perspective, 8 points on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, to put it in perspective, 10 points is the equivalent of an entire year's worth of learning. So we're talking about these kids being behind nearly a year relative to where they were a decade ago. And unfortunately, the story is even worse for disadvantaged children, for low-income children. They declined even further. And, you know, we can point to COVID and we can point to recent lackluster outcomes, but this has been an ongoing problem for decades. If you go all the way back to 1965, when Lyndon Johnson launched the War on Poverty, there was the equivalent of about 4 grade levels difference between low-income children and more affluent children. It's sometimes referred to as the 90-10 gap. Today, it is exactly the same. There is 4 grade levels difference between low-income kids and upper-income kids. And so the whole point of the War on Poverty, and then 20 years later, when Carter launched the Department of Education to try to narrow these gaps, the federal government has failed on every objective measure.
It's interesting, Lindsay, that a lot of times, particularly for the low-income students, they're in school districts that are subpar relative to more affluent school districts. One of the ways to get around that would be to give students and parents school choice options. Is there anything that can be done at the federal level to encourage, and in some cases, if necessary, force states and school districts to provide school choice options, education freedom to students and parents?
Yeah, there certainly is. And you're right to sort of couch it in those terms, right? The federal government is a really small stakeholder in overall spending. Even though they spend a lot, federal taxpayers spend a lot, it's still only about 10% of everything that's spent on K-12 education. States and localities pay for 90%+ of everything that we spend in K-12 schools. And so for the most part, really robust school choice efforts have to happen and should happen too for just good governance purposes at the state and local level. But there are things that Congress can do, particularly for kids who are clearly under Congress's jurisdiction. I'm thinking populations like active duty military families, where there is a national security imperative for the federal government to make sure these children have access to schools of choice that work for them, are safe and effective, and are aligned with their values. And so providing military families with school choice rather than assigning their kids to whatever public school happens to be nearby, the duty station that their parents assigned to, would be a really good first step. Native American children come to mind as well. The federal government operates the worst schools in America, and these are Bureau of Indian Affairs schools that are leaving these kids many, many grade levels behind their Native American peers in public schools. So giving them school choice opportunities. Children in Washington, D.C., D.C. is a federal city, despite what some folks in D.C. might not want to hear, it is under the jurisdiction of Congress. And so creating a universal school choice in D.C. would be another option. There are other people talking about a federal tax credit at the federal level. There are options to do things like condition a state's municipal bond exclusion on having a school choice program. So there are a lot of creative ways that the federal government expanding 529 savings accounts to homeschooling families can advance school choice in a way that's appropriate.
Which brings us back to the Department of Education. As you mentioned, only 10% of the money spent on education comes from the federal government. But when you look at the Department of Education, how much of that 10% is being eaten up in bureaucracy? And do we really need that agency to be anything other than just a pass-through to the states and school districts?
You're so right. That's what it is. It's a pass-through. It is where federal taxpayers, you and me and every family in America, are forced to send their hard-earned dollars to Washington to filter it through the Department of Education, which is a 4,300-employee bureaucracy, and then send that money back to local schools and somehow think that that's the formula for improving educational outcomes. If we were going to start a system, education system from scratch tomorrow, I guarantee you that's not how we would design it. And to your question, we know, based on a report called Education at a Crossroads that was commissioned several decades ago now, in fact, that only 65 cents on every, quote, federal dollar makes it back to the classroom. So we know a lot is getting taken off the top. And I would add, too, the former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos made this point really nicely the other day when she said, you have to remember the U.S. Department of Education does not run a single school in America. It does not pay a single teacher salary. It does not educate a single child in America. It's a large bureaucracy designed to funnel money back to states and localities in an incredibly efficient and ineffective manner.
We have been talking with Lindsay Burke, who is director of the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. And Lindsay, tell us a bit about Heritage Foundation, and you've written extensively on this topic. Where can folks find those writings?
We're a broad-based public policy foundation engaged in all kinds of issues, domestic and international, of importance to the American people. But education is our bread and butter. And at the Center for Education Policy, we work day and night to advance education freedom, meaning school choice for families and limiting federal intervention in education. And you can learn more about our work at heritage.org. And I'm on X or Twitter at Lindsay M. Burke.
Lindsay Burke from the Heritage Foundation. Lindsay, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on the reconciliation process in Congress. In this past week, a major step toward getting that started has taken place in the U.S. House of Representatives. It sort of defied the odds, so we're going to talk about that with Scott. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
This process is reconciliation is something that I would venture to say most Americans do not understand. Maybe many members of Congress might not understand it either. But we took a major step this past week. So what does that do and how do we move forward from here?
Yeah, it is important to say that this was a major step in the right direction. The House of Representatives passed a budget resolution with 217 votes. To 216. Only Thomas Massie of Kentucky voted against the resolution. And really, this was a nail biter for many of us in the DC area watching it on C-SPAN. They held a vote open prior to the budget resolution for over an hour, trying to make sure that they could get the last holdout to vote yes and not fail on this budget resolution vote. Ultimately, a couple of members like Warren Davidson, Victoria Sparks, and Tim Burchett voted in support of the budget resolution just to keep the process moving forward. What this means is it's sort of like halftime with the budget resolution. You need both chambers of Congress, the House and Senate, to pass identical budget resolutions in order to start that reconciliation process where we're actually going to be debating legislation to extend the Trump tax cuts, enhance border security, enhance defense spending, have pro-energy reforms included, and some other anomalies that'll include deregulation, maybe some school choice, lots of things that have to do with federal spending, federal revenues, and even the debt limit. So the House budget resolution actually included a $4 trillion debt limit increase, but now as it's punted over to the United States Senate, there's a bunch of Republican senators that are saying, well, hold on a second, we have some ideas too. And right now, the prediction from me would be that the Senate does amend the House budget resolution, and that would require an additional passage in the House of Representatives. There's a few key issues that are outstanding right now. Number one, the House budget resolution allows for $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. And it also provides for $1.5 trillion in spending cuts at a minimum. If the House can pass a reconciliation bill with more than $2 trillion in spending cuts, the resolution allows for a dollar-for-dollar trade-off where you could cut an extra dollar of taxes for every federal dollar that's also cut. Well, we're not sure how that's going to fly over in the United States Senate. The Senate also wants permanency, so they're arguing for what's known as a current policy baseline. We talked about this a couple weeks ago on your show, and the summary that I would say is if Congress extends the tax cuts, you're not going to see any difference. But if they don't, you're going to see a huge tax increase. For the average family in America, it'll be over $1,600. And when you think about, you know, the rising inflation and sort of the economic malaise we've felt over the last 4 years, $1,600 is a lot to a family that's already paycheck. The Senate is trying to get permanency for these tax cuts. The problem with reconciliation is that if you look at the deficit impact of a bill outside of the 10-year window, it can't increase the deficit.
One of the complicating factors here, Scott, is that you have conservatives in the House who are concerned about the deficit, who want to cut spending. And then there are some relative moderates in the Republican conference who are not really wanting to cut that deeply. Is that going to be a problem going forward? Somehow Speaker Johnson managed to hold it all together to get this process started, but a big challenge going forward?
Yeah, it is. And if you think about what the resolution is, it's basically the creation of the credit card, not spending or, you know, actually making any law. A budget resolution is not even signed into law by the president. So it's basically creating the framework. And the other complicating factor is that on March 14th, the continuing resolution expires. So there's a bunch of members in the House that wanted a path forward on what's going to happen on federal spending. Are we going to cut spending on an actual appropriation bill? As we've been discussing DOGE with Elon Musk, as we've been discussing the cuts that could be provided in the reconciliation bill, it's going to be a big challenge for them. The Democrats want to come out there and and demagogue Republicans for cutting Medicaid, but the budget resolution does not even mention the word Medicaid. That program has become totally unsustainable. And so when you think about the 25-year-old healthy adult that could be working and instead is on Medicaid, we need real reforms. We need to cut out the waste, fraud, and abuse to the Medicaid program. So it's going to be interesting to see how this process all unfolds. We're watching really closely here at the Club for Growth in Washington, and we are very optimistic about getting a big, beautiful bill done in the next 100 days.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, we certainly are going to keep an eye on this process as it goes step by step. Want to tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth, Scott?
Well, Club for Growth is united in the idea of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. The website is clubforgrowth.org. You can learn more and even sign up as a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being back with us.
You're welcome.
Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has the second in a two-part interview with U.S. Senator Rand Paul. They discuss the senator's efforts to determine the real origin of the COVID-19 virus. Eric?
Hi, folks. Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine here. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. If you joined us last week, you heard part one of my interview with Senator Rand Paul, where I talked to the senator about what I think has been the most exciting, the most attention-grabbing part of the new Trump administration, and that is the DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, Elon Musk's attempt to disrupt and slash government spending, and the administrative state. And if you missed that conversation, then you should go back to last week's program, and you should check it out. This week, in part two of my interview with Senator Rand Paul, we covered two other topics, trade policy and his ongoing investigation into the origins of COVID-19. Both very important topics, and we're going to jump back into those now. And we once again welcome Senator Rand Paul to the program. Now, look, Senator, of course, the Trump administration, any presidential administration has, at this point, huge powers over trade policy, thanks to decades of Congress kind of offloading that responsibility. Trump has threatened tariffs on, I think just about everybody at this point, Canada, Mexico, Europe, various products from all around the world. And he's in the process of trying to put together what he's calling reciprocal tariffs, though it's a little bit unclear what that means. So let's just cut right to the chase here. Should the president have the ability, as he apparently does, to just wave his magic wand and essentially raise taxes on all the imports that come into the United States?
No. I mean, the Constitution's pretty clear that taxes are supposed to be raised by Congress and ultimately signed by the president, and it's supposed to originate in the House. I don't know how we got away from, not only does it not originate in the House, it doesn't even originate in Congress. He's able to do it with a stroke of the pen. So I believe this is wrong. I have a bill that's introduced that's called No Taxation Without Representation. We fought the revolution over it, and we really shouldn't be allowing taxes on, you know, vast swaths of our economy without a vote of Congress. I think if you tax something, you'll get less of it. It's interesting that most Republicans will tell you they're not for raising taxes, and then they're for raising taxes on trade. It comes from a misconception that trade is not mutually beneficial. They think that somehow trade is benefiting one side at the expense of the other. And it's just frankly not true. All trade is voluntary. That's what a trade is. If it's not voluntary, it's not a trade. So if I buy furniture from you and I give you $2,000 for it, you want my $2,000 more than you want your furniture, and I want your furniture more than I want my $2,000. And so we make a trade, and we both think we won, or we won't make the trade. It's mutually beneficial. Trade with foreign countries is the same. So when people talk about trade deficits, it's kind of like, well, what about your trade deficit with a giant grocery store? Well, mine's enormous. Every year I spend like $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year on food, and they never buy anything from me. So my trade deficit with the grocery store is enormous, but it means absolutely nothing. But I think it's a dangerous thing to put on tariffs, particularly now when we still have pretty persistent inflation.
One of the other things that Trump has talked about is using tariffs to potentially offset income taxes, maybe in whole or in part. I mean, I know the math kind of doesn't work on that, but even if you did it as a partial offset, is that something that you and your Senate colleagues would be open to looking at as part of or independent from the big tax bill that has to get done at some point this year?
it's not going to be discussed or even offered. It's great rhetoric. But the personal income tax is quite large, and the tariffs wouldn't be nearly in the same category. But even if it were a trade-off of a lower personal income tax for tariffs, I might be open. I don't think taxes are good in any form, and I don't like taxing trade. But the personal income tax is a tax on all consumption and production, and so it's not a good idea for the economy either. But there's a lot of craziness going on with this. But the only thing that will get people back in line with understanding the effects of tariffs is if they precipitate a catastrophe. And if he puts a 25% tariff on all Canadian goods and all Mexican goods, I think you will see a catastrophe. I think you'll see a recession. You'll see dramatic rise in prices in the goods that are protected, as well as the goods that have retaliatory tariffs on. And I don't want to see that, but I am worried that that could happen.
Yeah. I certainly don't think anyone wants to see that. We are chatting with Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. Senator, I know we only have a couple of minutes left here, but I want to squeeze in one more thing if I can before we let you go. Gain of function research, particularly as it relates to what the U.S. has funded and how that relates to the potential origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, this is, this is something the Trump administration seems interested in possibly having a pause on gain of function research. Is that pause going to work? I know there have been other attempts to kind of constrain that sort of research. Do you have any reason to think that this will be different or more effective than before? And do you think the Trump administration is going to be more transparent and more forthcoming about just trying to get to the bottom of the origins of COVID in the first place?
Yeah, we've issued 14 subpoenas to 14 different agencies looking for evidence concerning the U.S. funding of the research in Wuhan, who approved it, why it didn't go to the safety committee, et cetera. I think we're going to get that. As far as trying to prevent something like this from happening again, we have legislation called the Risky Research Review Act, and we passed it last time with bipartisan support out of our committee, but we didn't get a full floor vote. We're hoping to pass that, and instead of a ban, what it would be is the president appoints 9 different scientists, and there's different parameters and different viruses that are part of a select list. And any research done with gain of function would have to go before this committee. I think it's better than an outright ban because I'm open-minded enough to say, well, maybe they could have some research that might be worth doing. I think it's unlikely. I think most gain of function is simply dangerous without any great benefits from it. No vaccine's ever been made through gain of function research, and typically I think it is too dangerous to be performed. But I think having a committee is a better way to do it, a committee of scientists outside the bureaucracy. They would not be scientists that get NIH grants. The problem under Fauci was that basically he would appoint people who agreed with him that there was no problem with this research, and then you'd get more research grants if you voted the way he wanted you to vote. And so it's a bad situation, but I'm hopeful with this administration we're going to do much better.
Well, we really appreciate your time, Senator. Thank you so much for your thoughts on these important topics. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that is Senator Rand Paul. He is a Republican senator from the state of Kentucky. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bam. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Donald Trump is attempting to broker a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. But some of his comments have triggered controversy. We learn more from Dr. Paul Kengor, editor-in-chief of the American Spectator, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
This is really scary, so says a conservative friend of mine in an email. He continued, Putin is the new Hitler, and it appears Donald Trump is the new Neville Chamberlain. I'm guessing Trump is not a big fan of studying history since he's probably doomed to repeat it. My friend is neither never Trump nor certainly always Trump, as you could tell from that email. He and I both marvel at Donald Trump's ability to shoot himself in the foot. Many conservatives have been thrilled with what Trump has done domestically in his whirlwind initial weeks in office. But then, presto, the man uncorks and says some wildly stupid things about Ukraine. With his comments about Volodymyr Zelensky, we see yet again how Donald Trump can often be his own worst enemy. And so what of my friend's assessment of Trump as a new Neville Chamberlain because of Trump's comments about Zelensky calling him a dictator? Well, when pressed to defend this accusation, always Trumpers note that Zelensky hasn't stood for election since his country was invaded by Putin 3 years ago. That's correct. However, Ukraine's laws and constitution, and also majority public opinion, permits the leader not to stand for re-election during a time of war and martial law, a very reasonable provision. In fact, get this, folks, the British people had the same policy during World War II. The great Winston Churchill never stood for election until late July 1945, after the Nazis surrendered. Now, before anti-Trump liberals cheer my Churchill analogy, you folks might want to remind yourselves that for a decade or so now, you've been canceling Churchill, maligning him as everything from a colonialist to a racist. Barack Obama ejected the Churchill bus from the Oval Office as soon as Obama got there. The heroic Churchill, however, saved the West. Brits turned to him during their darkest hour when the Nazi beast that Neville Chamberlain appeased was at the gates. As for Donald Trump, it's hard to picture him as another Neville Chamberlain. Consider, Donald Trump understands that he's probably the only international leader in the world that can negotiate between Zelensky and Putin. Who else could? France's Macron? Canada's Justin Trudeau? Britain's new weak prime minister? The Germans only last weekend held an election for their next chancellor. So the mediator position has fallen to Donald Trump, for better or worse. As for Trump's words about Zelensky, well, by now we should have learned not to take Trump's words too literally. His actions mean more. Yes, his latest words about Ukraine and Zelensky were idiotic, outrageous. They've stunned even some of his most sycophantic supporters. Fox's Brian Kilmeade responded by trying to get Trump in an interview to call Vladimir Putin a dictator. Trump wouldn't do it. The conservative New York Post, very friendly to Donald Trump, called out Trump for that, running a picture of Putin under the headline, "This is a dictator." And Trump's staff, well, now they're in the position of defending his stupid statements about Zelensky. At CPAC last week, Trump advisor Rick Grenell was pushed to do just that. Embarrassingly, Grenell didn't contradict his boss's obnoxious words. But that said, Trump is no doubt taking some shots at Zelensky for negotiating reasons, probably to show the Russians that he can be an even broker holding both sides' feet to the fire. Now, that's not to imply that Trump is necessarily crazy like a fox. He bloviates reckless statements all the time. But again, we've learned not to take his words too seriously. It's the actions that count. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if Donald Trump negotiated a ceasefire. I'd bet he does better than President Biden did. Thus far, already in his second term, Donald Trump can take pride in getting Mark Fogel released by Putin. Moreover, always be mindful that in Trump's first term, Vladimir Putin kept his hands off of Ukraine. Vlad the Impaler had invaded the Crimea in 2014 during the Obama presidency. He didn't march into Kiev until February 2022 under Joe Biden. In the meantime, however, it's painful to hear embarrassing statements like those from Trump calling Zelensky rather than Putin a dictator. So, what will happen with Donald Trump in Ukraine and Russia? I don't know. But here's hoping and praying that Trump's actions will be far better than his words, and that history will prove Donald Trump a broker of peace rather than the next Neville Chamberlain. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KSAK-FM in Walnut, California, KRBL-FM in Lubbock, Texas, along with KCEA-FM in Redwood City, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.